Talk Shoe.
Recorded live.
All right. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here with another installment of Christogenos with my guest host and sidekick here, William Fink. We've been studying the book of Jeremiah, which is probably one of the most phenomenal books of prophecy in the Old Testament. Of course, they all have their different perspectives and points of view and telling us about different aspects of prophecy, but all of them tell us exactly what our people, the Anglo-Saxon, Celtic, and Caucasian people, who are the true Israelites of the Bible, will be going through since the day that these prophecies were written. So we left off last week at chapter 25. Bill, do you have a summary for us?
Yeah, I have a synopsis. Last week in chapters 21 through 24, we saw that in Judah's sin, the only hope left was destruction, mm-hmm. so that a remnant would be preserved in captivity. And that was the only that was the ultimatum given to Judah. If Yahweh had left the city as it was, in the direction it was heading, all of them would have been race mixed or otherwise destroyed by the appointed time which he'd already chosen for his advent. Mm-hmm. So he sent them into captivity, as is explained, for their own good. And in Jeremiah chapter 24, right? The good and the bad figs. The bad figs were going into captivity for their eventual disgrace and destruction. This is the message of Jeremiah chapter 24, where we saw two mm-hmm. baskets of figs.
Right.
The good figs were going into captivity to preserve them and protect them from the bad figs.
Right.
Upon the return 70 years later, we see that most of the people were good figs, true Judahites. But even then, there were among the people some claiming to be priests who were not found in the official genealogies, which were kept by the Levites in all the major cities in Israel, mm-hmm. as we see in Ezra chapter 2, verses 61 and 62. Even while most of the bad figs may not have returned to Judea to share in the history of the 70 weeks nation, the subsumption of the Edomites into Judea and the beginnings of what is today called Judaism, they were nevertheless identified with those same people all the while that they were in Babylonia. And there's a good historic record of that. They remained an important part of what would later come to be known as Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
Neither did all of the good figs return to Jerusalem, for which cause Peter's apostolic mission is found in Babylonia, from where he later wrote his epistles. Any good figs remaining, and there had to be good figs or there would be no remnant.
Right.
Once they received the gospel at the time of Christ, upon its acceptance, they would have lost their identity as Judeans, and therefore they would never have been called Jews, right?
Mm-hmm.
Any good figs who did not receive the gospel would have eventually mixed themselves with their bad fig co-religionists and
right.
all of the other races which they have mingled with in their wanderings.
Just Christians are doing today.
All right. And so there are truly no good fig Judeans or Jews left today. There can't possibly be,
yeah.
nor have there been for many centuries. In chapter 22, we also saw the curse of Jeconiah, which forbade any of his physical descendants from ever ruling again in Jerusalem. For that reason, even while they were among those who returned, we see instead that the Levitical priests ruled in the kingdom until the time of Herod. Now, with Jeremiah chapter 25, we are at the 70-year prophecy of Jeremiah, which is not to be confused with the 70-week prophecy of Daniel, which is actually a 490-year prophecy, right? Once we get to 25:13, the chapters of Jeremiah in the Masoretic text, which the King James Version is based upon, they differ greatly in order from that of the Septuagint of Jeremiah. And as we get to each of those sections, I'll make note of those differences as we proceed.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The chapters are way after 25:13. The chapters are way out of sync with the Septuagint.
Uh huh. Oh, okay.
And I'll make notes so that people could write it in their Bibles or whatever. But it's very difficult to keep track of, right? Because it's some of really jumbled.
Yeah. In general, though, chapter 24 tells us about how Yahweh admonishes and chastises his own children. for the sins they commit. And one of the greatest heresies that we have in Judeo-Christianity today is that Yahweh does not chastise his children. He loves us so much that he would not chastise us, right? That's what
they're telling. Well, absolutely, and we'll look at more of that chastisement in the chapters to come.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
There's no doubt it's throughout Jeremiah.
Right, and the book of Revelation, Matthew chapter 24, chapter 25, many of them are actually continuing in the tradition of the Old Testament of this chastisement because his vesture is dipped in blood.
Right. I'm sorry. Yeah. You know, the Judeo-Christians love to quote Paul. And Paul's a totally legitimate apostle, but they really don't quote Paul at all except for two verses, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
If they really understood Paul, they would know that Paul said that if you're without chastisement in this life, it's very likely that you're a bastard and not a son.
Right.
So basically, if you're one of the children of God, you have to expect to be chastised if, in fact, you are acting as a child of God.
Right, right. Yeah, I'm going to need a machine gun tonight. But here we go. Jeremiah chapter 25. The word that came to Jeremiah concerning all the people of Judah, of course, we're talking about Judahites, not Jews, and I think when we did our first show last week on the Restoration Hour, and I went through the different definitions of the word Jew, okay? And all of these words in the Old Testament come from some form of Yehudi, meaning the specific descendants of Judah and no one else, okay? And everybody ought to know by now, certainly in Christian identity, and most Christians should know this, but they don't, that the Jewish people can be composed of any and all races. They don't teach anything that's in the law of Moses. In fact, most of their teachings are diametrically opposed to the laws of Moses. So the modern word Jew has no business being in the Old Testament. It just has no business being there. And most Christians simply do not understand this. And, you know, they look at, and our people are very literal. They see a word in the Bible and it says Jew. And then, their first instinct is, well, it says Jew right there. It must mean what it says, right? But it never occurs to them that it's a linguistic trick.
Well, right. We don't apply that term to the people of the Old Testament because today's Jews are not the people of the Old Testament.
That's right.
Just like all of the Puerto Ricans in the Bronx aren't the original New Yorkers.
That's right. That's right. And, of course, they don't understand that. You know, you simply take a word at face value and have no historical concept or context to wrap that concept around. Then, obviously, and, of course, since the pulpit bastards in the Judeo churches are constantly preaching that falsehood, it never occurs to, a good Christian sitting in the pew, are they lying to me? That's not possible. They can't be lying to me. They're pastors, right? They're ministers. They can't be lying to me. All right, chapter 25, verse 1.
I have a chronological note.
Oh, okay.
Since we've taken this departure, right?
Okay.
Jeremiah's ministry began in the days of Josiah in his 13th year, and that was at approximately 627 B.C. Jehoiakim, who's mentioned here, he came to rule circa 609 B.C. until around 598 B.C.,
mm-hmm.
Now, the destruction of Jerusalem isn't until 586 or 585 B.C. So we now have two measures which tell us that this is around 605 or 604 B.C. And Daniel was taken captive in the third year of Nebuchadnezzar around 604 or 603 B.C. because he came to the throne in 606. So we see that this event is also about to happen, and Jeremiah will cover it later.
Mm-hmm.
So we can safely estimate that it's around 605 or 604 B.C. right now in Jeremiah.
Okay, very good. I didn't read the whole verse because I sidetracked on the word Judah. So let me read it again. The word that came to Jeremiah concerning all the people of Judah in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, that was the first year of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. Verse 2, in which Jeremiah the prophet spoke to all the people of Judah and to all the inhabitants of Jerusalem, saying, from the 30th year of Josiah the son of Ammon, king of Judah, even to this day, that is the 23rd year, the word of Yahweh has come to me, and I have spoken to you rising early and speaking, but you have not hearkened. But what else is new? The Israelites never hearkened, right? And even the New Testament, the prophecies concerning the end times reveal the fact that a great delusion and a great apostasy will fall upon the vast majority of Israelites in the end times. And boy, has that come true. And our stiff necks refuse to hear the truth. Verse 5, verse 4. And Yahweh has sent to you all his servants, the prophets, rising early and sending them, but you have not hearkened nor inclined your ear to hear. They said, turn you again now, everyone, from his evil way and from the evil of your doings, and dwell in the land that Yahweh has given to you and to your fathers forever and ever. So we would have, our ancestors would have had Jerusalem forever and ever had they not continually sinned. Verse 6, and go not after other gods to serve them and to worship them, and provoke me not to anger with the works of your hands, and I will do you no hurt. Okay? That's a fair bargain. Okay? Verse 7, yet you have not hearkened to me, says Yahweh, that you might provoke me to anger with the works of your hands to your own hurt. Therefore, thus says Yahweh of hosts, because you have not hearkened to my words, behold, I will send and take all the families of the north, says Yahweh, and Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, will bring them against this land and against the inhabitants thereof and against all these nations round about, and I will utterly destroy them and make them an astonishment and a hissing and perpetual desolations. And let me just pause here. I'm sure you've got some comments already from these verses. And it is, in fact, today true. It has come true among our people that we are an astonishment and a hissing and desolations. And people call us, names like Evil Whitey or White Trash or Ami Go Home and Honky, things like that, okay? So it's okay for for non-whites to call us names and put us down, but if we try to defend ourselves and say, hey, wait a minute, there's a double standard here, right? Our people are taking us without complaint. How is this possible? It's incredible.
Well, it is incredible, and people that they don't understand the curses of the Old Testament. Even when Christians read the Old Testament, they can't relate that the reproach that our race is undergoing at this time, the punishments of Deuteronomy and Leviticus, where the beasts of the field and the aliens in our land rise up above us, that's what's happening right now, and it's a result of our sin.
Right.
What is our sin? I believe that the primary, the chief sin of the white Christians in this nation today is worshiping the idols of the Jews, worshiping the image of the beast.
Right.
Yet you're watching niggers run up and down fields with balls in their hand that are making $40, $50, $60 million a piece.
Right.
They have contracts that are valued much more than most of us will ever make in a lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And we're worshiping these people every Sunday.
Yeah.
And our own people are going to church, and then they go home and they glue themselves to the television for the rest of the winter.
Yeah.
Oh, worshiping the beast. And then their daughters bring a beast home, and how do they tell their daughters no?
Right.
Daddy, I brought home one of your heroes.
Yeah, exactly. Right. That reminds me of the word I was looking for, white devils. That's what they call us, white devils.
I was first called a white devil on the streets of Jersey City. I was 16 years old. I had no idea what they were talking about. I passed one of those storefront mosques with a whole bunch of Negro Muslims standing outside, right?
Right.
And they said, look at that white devil, right? White devil. I had no idea. Why the hell are they calling me? I had no conception.
Yeah, you never did anything bad to them, right? But all the propaganda they hear is that we're to blame for all their problems. But if they would only work for a living, they might not have so many problems. The Bible says, he who does not work shall not eat. There's no communism in the Bible. All right, verse 10. Moreover, I will take from them the voice of mirth and the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom. Boy, are we experiencing that today as a people?
And well, we're going to see this in Revelation chapter 18 and 19, the same exact language.
Yeah.
Talking about the fall of Babylon.
Right. Yeah, and our people, of course, have been married to Babylon now for the last 100 years. The sound of the voice of the bridegroom, the voice of the bride, the sound of the millstones, and the light of the candle, and this whole land shall be a desolation and an astonishment, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. And it shall come to pass, when 70 years are accomplished, that I will punish the king of Babylon and that nation, says Yahweh, for their iniquity and the land of the Chaldeans, and will make it perpetual desolations. Now, of course, I think you have a lot to say about this one here, perpetual desolations.
Okay. Well, it was Babylon was taken by the Persians in 539 B.C., I believe.
Right.
And that was roughly 70 years after Nebuchadnezzar rose to power.
Mm-hmm.
In 606 B.C. It wasn't quite 70 years. It was rough. And this is by our chronologies, which are always faulty, right?
Right.
They're never perfect. They can't be. Well, we just don't have enough information. But aside from that, Babylon really didn't become perpetual desolations probably until the 3rd or 4th century A.D.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know exactly when it the city fell into disuse, but it eventually simply fell into disuse because the harbor silted up.
Right. Oh, okay.
And the Gulf of the Persian Gulf was actually pushed because of all the silting. It was actually pushed miles south eventually of where it is to where it is today.
Right.
And the city became more or less useless. It wasn't good for trade anymore, and people ceased using it. And it fell into decay until, I think it was Woolley dug it up out of the ground in the 1920s and 30s, right?
Right. Yeah, well, the prophecy is 70 years. I think it's pretty well set that this occurred in 586 B.C.,
Well, right, but I'm going, you know, they served the king of Babylon 70
right.
years, and that is roughly true, but they were also in captivity 70 years.
Right.
And it was a different 70 years. From 586 B.C., when Jerusalem was finally destroyed, all right, until it was 520-something when Cyrus gave them permission to return to Judea, and 516, I believe, is the year that they rededicated the temple or began to rebuild it.
Yeah.
Laid the foundation stone of it 70 years later.
Right. Okay. Yeah, and then they were, the yoke of the Babylonians was taken off of them in 539 B.C., but they were still captive in Babylon under the Medes and Persians. So they didn't start returning back to Jerusalem. So even though there was a change of empires, they were still captive until 516 B.C. Okay, very good.
Now I have a pretty thorough chronology of this period.
Okay.
On my website at christogenia.org/7070weeks notes. No spaces. 70 weeks notes.
Okay.
And there's a pretty thorough chronology of this period there.
Okay. Excellent. Okay, verse 13. And I will bring upon that land all my words which I have pronounced against it. And if Yahweh pronounces something, it happens, folks. Even all that is written in this book, which Jeremiah has prophesied against all the nations, for many nations and great kings shall serve themselves of them also. Now here's this expression, shall serve themselves of them. It occurs in many of these, especially in Ezekiel and Jeremiah and Isaiah. And it means that other races will feed off of us. That's what it means. And you look at America today, the white middle class taxpayer is paying for all of the transfer payments, all of the welfare. We're paying for illegal aliens for their education, schooling, and office. They get cheaper rates of interest on mortgages than we do, right? They get free education. We don't get free education. So the Jew has arranged everything so that other races feed off of us. They serve themselves off of us. That's exactly what we're being told right here.
Well, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I have a few notes in reference to this, a few more notes in reference to the 70 weeks, right?
Okay.
I'm sorry, to Jeremiah's 70 years. Daniel understood these words of Jeremiah, and chapter 9 of his prophecy opens where he requests of Yahweh to know what will become of Jerusalem. And in Daniel 9:2, he says, in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood by books the number of the years whereof the word of Yahweh came to Jeremiah the prophet, that he would accomplish 70 years in the desolation of Jerusalem. Now, Zechariah was a prophet of the return, right? Daniel was a prophet of the captivity. Zechariah was a prophet of the during the return to Jerusalem.
Okay.
And he wrote this at Zechariah 7:5. Speak unto all the people of the land and to the priests, saying, when you fasted and mourned in the fifth and seventh month, even those 70 years, did you at all fast even unto me?
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to read, I have a long passage from One Esdras. If people would check out One Esdras in the Apocrypha, One Esdras is a much better and historically can be shown to be much more accurate and more complete version of the Book of Ezra.
Okay.
That than what we have in the Bible that's called the Book of Ezra, right?
Mm-hmm.
And One Esdras 46 through 58, and this will show what the sin of these people was, right?
Yeah.
And when this passage is read. And they, Zechariah, king of Judah and Jerusalem, when he was 21 and 20 years old, and he reigned 11 years. Zedekiah, he was the last king of Judea, right? Of Judah. And he did evil also in the sight of Yahweh, and cared not for the words that were spoken unto him by the prophet Jeremy from the mouth of Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
And after that king, Nebuchadnezzar came, and that's the same as Nebuchadnezzar, yes, and made him to swear by the name of Yahweh. He forswore himself and rebelled, and hardening his neck, his heart, he transgressed the laws of the Lord of Yahweh, God of Israel. And the governors also of the people and the priests did many things against the laws and passed all the pollutions of the nations and defiled the temple of Yahweh. They actually defiled the temple, which was sanctified in Jerusalem. Nevertheless, the God of their fathers sent by his messenger to call them back because he spared them and his tabernacle also. But they had his messengers in derision, meaning the prophets, and look, when Yahweh spoke unto them, they had made sport of his prophets.
Right.
So far forth that he, being wroth with his people for their great ungodliness, commanded the kings of the Chaldees, that the Hebrews saw that Yahweh commanded the kings of the Chaldees to come up against them.
Right.
That's the way they saw this history.
Yeah.
Who slew their young men with the sword, even within the compass of their holy temple, and spared neither young man nor maid, old man nor child among them, for he delivered all into their hands. And they took all the holy vessels of Yahweh, both great and small, with the vessels of the ark of God and the king's treasures, and carried them away to Babylon. As for the house of Yahweh, they burnt it and broke down the walls of Jerusalem and set fire upon her towers. And as for her glorious things, they never ceased till they had consumed and brought them all to naught. And the people that were not slain with the sword, he carried to Babylon, who became his servants to him and his children until the Persians reigned to fulfill the word of Yahweh spoken by the mouth of Jeremy, until he had enjoyed her Sabbaths. The whole time of her desolation shall she rest until the full term of 70 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I promised last week to show that when the Babylonians took Jerusalem, it was the Edomites who destroyed the temple in Jerusalem.
Okay.
And this can be seen in two scriptures. One, Esdras 4:45. And this will be mentioned again later in a different context, I think in Jeremiah chapter 27. One, Esdras 4:45 says, thou hast also vowed to build up the temple which the Edomites burned when Judea was made desolate by the Chaldees. The Edomites had become the allies of the Babylonians.
That's right.
And they were basically told to do that by Yahweh. Mm-hmm. And we will see that in Jeremiah, I think it's chapter 27.
Well,
Psalm 130.
Like we're trying to say, Yahweh uses other people against us when we sin.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
And here it's, yeah, you know, the Book of Nezar is called his servant. And the Book of Nezar is a Chaldean, which means that by blood, he's Assyrian. He's from Aram. And there's no, you know, I believe that he probably was a real Aramean. And that's because of the years of Nebuchadnezzar's madness where he was punished by Yahweh, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you're punished, if you're chastised, you're a son,
right,
and not a bastard. Right,
right? Exactly.
And the Book of Nezar was punished. He was chastised by Yahweh in the Book of Daniel. And then after his chastisement, he was restored, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that shows that he must have been of the Adamic race,
right,
and not a bastard.
Right.
Psalm 137 supports 1 Esdras 4:45, where it says in verses 7 through 9, "Remember, O Yahweh, the children of Edom in the day of Jerusalem," meaning the day of its destruction, "who said, raise it, even to the foundation thereof. O daughter of Babylon, who art to be destroyed, happy shall he be that rewards thee as thou hast served us. Happy shall he be that takes and dashes thy little ones against the stone."
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we see that the Edomites had destroyed the first temple,
right,
without a doubt.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, okay. Any more on that? Or,
No, now we could go on.
Yeah, okay. All right, yeah, and it's important to understand, because it's definitely two seed line teaching, and the anti-seed lenders are constantly asserting making a false statement that Genesis 3:15 is the only verse in the Bible that can be used to justify two seed line.
Well, that's Ted Weenieland's
point. Yeah, right.
And I've challenged him to debates through email, and he just doesn't even acknowledge me, right?
Right, right. Well,
I guess I'm some kind of ruffian or something.
Well, he knows he's going to get beat badly.
Well, right. And Clifton has basically confronted him in emails,
uh-huh,
and sent him. Yeah, you know, when Clifton writes a paper concerning a particular error, He sends it to that person that's
right,
the subject of the paper.
Yeah.
And Ted Weenieland has been the recipient of many of the
last couple
papers.
Of dozen, I'm sure.
Right. Well,
yeah.
Basically, he claims that the only verse we have is Genesis 3:15 and maybe John 8:44. He has some kind of crazy claim like that.
Right.
And I could name two dozen
right,
line verses. Well, Luke 11 and,
right,
and Revelation 12, and it goes on and on.
Well, the whole Bible, from beginning to end, talks about Israel's enemies, namely the seed line of the Kenites, Canaanites, Edomites, Pharisees, Jews. I mean, they're always the enemies of Israel, and they're from the same. They have their father, Cain, as Jesus Christ in John 8:44 said, and also in Matthew 23:37, I believe, and many other places. Okay, and it says you have to be blind. You have to ignore the verses that talk about Israel's perpetual enemy. That's two seed line, Israel's perpetual enemy, and it began at 3:15. So it's really truthful to say that the entire Bible is about the two seed lines. You have to ignore all the verses about the Edomites and Canaanites not to see it. Right.
Well, right. And I think somebody made a real good analogy in the Christogenia Forum. His name is he goes by Verbal Vandal. Right.
Okay.
He wrote this little piece that said and it's pretty funny, actually. He wrote this little piece that said that if Satan's an individual, then the bride has to be an individual.
Right.
So if Satan is a single individual, so we better keep an eye out for a single individual bride. Right.
Yeah. Right. it's Madonna.
Right. If the bride is a family of people, then so is Satan.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good. Very good. Okay. Repeating here, verse 14. "For many nations and great kings shall serve themselves of them." That means us also. "And I will recompense them according to their deeds and according to the works of their own hands." Okay. Even though he's allowing them to serve themselves of us, to take advantage of us, to exploit us, you know, they're going to be judged too.
Right. And I have to say that this is the beginning of the departure from the order of the text between the Septuagint and the Masoretic text.
Okay.
Jeremiah 25:14 is completely wanting in the Septuagint.
Really?
And the verses from 25:15 through the end of the chapter are found in the Septuagint in chapter 32.
Okay.
In other words, there's a lot of material from later in the book of Jeremiah in between 25:13 and 25:15, right?
Okay, okay. So you're saying that the 14 is completely absent in the Septuagint?
Yes.
It's not there at all. It hasn't been just moved over somewhere.
No, I can't find it anywhere. I went looking for it. It's
a good verse.
well, right, and that's a shame. If we skip from here to chapter 32 in the Septuagint, we find 25:15.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
but not
we don't
14.
Find it.
Okay. No. Well, as you have said very often, the Masoretic text, it has tremendous value to us, because if even though it has been corrupted by the Masoretic Jews, who used they obviously had access to the original Hebrew, and the Septuagint was translated from the original Hebrew into Greek around 250 BC, 225 BC, something like that, by Judah, not by the Jews, okay? And the Septuagint is the text by which Jesus quoted, by which Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John quoted. When they were quoting the Old Testament, they were quoting the Septuagint, and many of those quotes that they made from the Old Testament are found in the Septuagint, but not in the Masoretic text, or they're sort of disturbed or distorted in the Masoretic text.
If I had to guess off the top of my head, I would say that 75% of the New Testament quotes are verbatim from the Septuagint, or darned close to verbatim.
Right, right.
Now, the other 25%, some of them follow the Masoretic text.
Uh-huh, right.
Some of them do, and some of them don't follow either.
Right.
There's a couple of passages that follow the Aramaic Targums, or that follow neither text that are different
uh-huh.
from either of them, different from both of them.
Right, right. And so, I think the best we can say is that the Masoretic text, despite its flaws, is still very valuable to us because, number one, we can corroborate the Septuagint versus the Masoretic. And where there's differences, it actually gives us a handle on how the method to the madness of how the Jews doctored the text, right? And they didn't doctor all of it. They just doctored some of it, major themes, you know, like Jew versus Judah, right, that we talked about already.
Well, right. A lot of it's the language of translation, and there's flaws in the language of translation in the Septuagint, and that's why we need the Masoretic text so that we can understand some of them.
Yeah.
But we also need Josephus,
mm-hmm.
and we need the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yeah, First and
the
Second
Dead
Ezra.
Sea Scrolls. a lot of the Jews were condemning the Septuagint, and when the Dead Sea Scrolls were studied, they had to stop condemning the Septuagint.
Right.
That they had to
right.
put their tails between their legs to a great extent.
Yeah.
The text was what was fudged or butchered more or less before Jeremiah's time, as we see in Jeremiah 8:8, where Yahweh says, "You think you have the law? The scribes, the pen of the scribes has turned it into a lie." Basically,
mm-hmm.
where they have altered parts of the law that we'll never be able to recover in this earth age, right?
Right.
Before the time of Christ.
Right.
Now the and I'm sure Genesis
might be one of them.
right. I'm sure Genesis 4:1 is one of them.
Uh-huh.
I don't think for the most part that the Masoretic Jews purposely sat down to make a text that's agreeable to them.
Right.
If they'd have done that, large parts of there's hundreds of messianic prophecies,
right.
Daniel chapter 9, that would have just disappeared if they'd have done that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that just through their nature, that their diabolical nature, they screwed it up, not even really insisting on screwing it up. And what they actually did was sat down at these councils and tried to settle on a common text
mm-hmm.
for all Jews, and for that reason that they butchered the text.
Right. Well, it seems obvious to me that there's certain words that they focused on, like Jew and Gentile and nation and words like that. And Adam. Adam's one of the big ones. It's always translated as man, right?
Well, they are misunderstandings of our comprehension and the way that we're trained, that we've ceded the understanding of this language to the Jew.
Right.
And exactly. We basically ceded the understanding of our own language to the Jew.
That's right. That's right, yeah.
The Jew is defined, has redefined how many words in English now.
Yeah, right. And they certainly, when their advice was sought, and very often when it wasn't sought, the King James translators relied upon Jewish opinion to make translations. And that's why the word goy is so horribly mistranslated in the Old Testament. You know, it should never be translated as Gentile. It should always be translated as nation.
Well, I'll say this. You know, Yahweh told Rebekah that there were two goy in her womb.
Right.
That means that no Jew is of the seed of Abraham.
There you go.
What that
is. Yeah, if the definition of goy is non-Jew, you're absolutely right, because that's how they define it.
Absolutely. So stick them with their own
definition. Yeah, right. Just stick them with their own fork, right? Very good. All right, verse 15. For thus says Yahweh Elohim of, For thus says Yahweh Elohim of Israel to me, take the wine cup of this fury at my hand, and cause all the nations, and that's goyim, plural for goy, to whom I send you to drink it, and they shall drink and be moved and be mad, that's crazy, because of the sword that I will send among them. Okay, now of course the Old Testament God is a God of wrath, but so is the New Testament God if you read carefully. Verse 17, then took I the cup at Yahweh's hand and made all the nations to drink, To whom Yahweh had sent me. Now let's suppose, here's the word nations, and it's obviously the word goyim. Let's take the definition provided for us by the Jews, and they inserted it into the Strong's Concordance as an afterthought. Whenever you see the word non-Jew as part of a definition in Strong's Concordance, it's always the very last entry, okay? Which means they inserted it after James Strong actually completed all this, and then they added it later. So let's read this as if, you know, insert their definition. Then I took the cup at Yahweh's hand and made all the non-Jewish nations to drink to whom Yahweh had sent me. Well, this might actually be in their favor here, but there's very, as you pointed out, Rebecca had two goyim in her womb, or two goy in her womb. That means no Jews. It means there's no Jews.
Well,
right?
That's a rhetorical device that can be used against them.
That's right.
But it's clear there are two goyim in thy womb.
Right.
I mean,
right.
The word means nations. It doesn't mean non-Jew. It can't be.
But the way the Jews use the word, they always use the word goy to mean non-Jews. That's what they mean by that word. Okay.
Well, the word never meant that.
It never did mean that. Right. Verse 18. That is Jerusalem and the cities of Judah. And that's the correct translation, not the cities of the Jews, the cities of Judah, and the kings thereof, and the princes, sometimes they get it right, to make them a desolation and astonishment, a hissing and a curse as it is today. Here we go, an astonishment, hissing, and a curse. And we are scorned today because we are Israelites, because we are white Israelites. Verse 19, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and his servants, and his princes, and all his people, and all the mingled people. Oh, what does that mean, mingled people?
Well, that's the Arabs.
There you go, mixed, yeah. Mestizo means mixed, too, in Spanish. And all the mingled people and all the kings of the land of Uz and all the kings of the land of the Philistines and Ashkelon and Azah and Ekron and the remnant of Ashdod, Edom and Moab and the children of Ammon, and all the kings of Tyrus, and all the kings of Zidon, and the kings of the Isles, which are beyond the sea. Who might those people be? Take a guess, Bill?
Well, right.
The British, right?
The nations.
Yeah, the British and the Irish. Yeah, exactly. And probably, you know, because if you go around the Straits of Gibraltar and go up the western coast of Europe, you get all those, Anglo nations. You know, like Spain used to be Anglo, right?
And what is that word mingled? Right. There are still some Anglo Spanish, but probably not many. But The word mingled in verse 20 actually is the Hebrew word Arab, which is the word that we get Arab from.
That's right. Very good. Very good. Okay. And all the kings of Tyrus and Zidon, the kings of the Isles of the Sea, Dedan and Tema and Booz, all that are in the uttermost corners. Who are these three? Dedan, Tema, and Booz. Any idea?
Well, Tema and Dedan were actually Ishmaelite slash Edomite cities in the south.
Oh, okay. Okay. And all the kings of Arabia and all the kings of the mingled people that dwelled in the desert, and that's pretty much what the Arabs became, mingled people in the desert. And all the kings of Zimri and all the kings of Elam and all the kings of the Medes. Now, the Medes, well, Elam and Medes were definitely white people. What about Zimri?
Well, right. I have some comments on Zimri in a minute. In 24, where we see kings of Arabia, right?
Yeah.
In 20, where we see all the mingled people, that is basically an adjective, Arab, and it's 6153 in Strong's Concordance.
Uh-huh.
And in this verse, in 24, that's a proper noun from that word. From Arab,
oh.
And it's Strong's number 6154,
okay.
Right? Well, which alone proved, I'm sorry, 6152, okay? And that's a noun, and that proves everything that I've said about the mingled people being the Arabs, and the word Arab meaning mixed,
uh-huh.
Right?
Right.
It's very documentable in the Hebrew Bible
right.
That the word Arab means mixed.
Yeah, it also means dark, too, doesn't it? It means
mixed
and dark.
You know, it means, as a verb, it means to grow dark. Yes,
okay,
it does.
Okay, as a verb.
Well, how do people grow dark?
Well, they go out and get suntan, right? But isn't there a different word in the Hebrew for that? It's translated often as bronzed.
There's several words in the Hebrew for turn right.
Yeah.
There's a different word for tanning, being burned by the sun, and that's used in Ecclesiastes, but I don't have it on the tip of my tongue.
Right. Right.
I'd like to talk about Zimri here.
Okay.
The mention of Zimri is very interesting, right? There's no historical or biblical place called Zimri.
Uh huh.
The name is the name of the chief of Simeon that's slain by Phinehas, right?
Okay.
Zimri.
Okay.
But it's also the name of the fifth king of the northern kingdom, okay? And Zimri, the fifth king of the northern kingdom, only reigned. He was a treacherous man, and he was a plotter, and he plotted. He was a captain of the guard, I believe, that plotted to take the kingdom by force.
Okay.
And he killed the king, and he reigned for 7 days by treachery. And when he died after 7 days by killing himself when his palace was on fire.
Mm-hmm.
And he was replaced by Omri.
Ah, right. Okay.
And I can't account for this Zimri anywhere, right? And I have to conjecture that perhaps Yahweh is, just like a lot of these other places, Yahweh is indeed meaning to refer to the scattering of his people, and thought that since the Assyrians were calling that the Israelites of the captivity after the name Qumri, which is the Assyrian form of Omri,
mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
That maybe Yahweh was basically slapping them in the face by instead calling them after the treacherous Zimri.
Right. Okay.
Because they are in these lands
right.
of Elam and Media. That,
right.
That's where the Bible says they were settled. And I
right.
can't find any, that there's no historic people named Zimri.
You son of a gun, you kings of Zimri, right.
Well right,
pejorative.
He's basically, using a pejorative.
Mm-hmm. Okay, anything about Elam and the Medes before we go?
Elam is Persia, right?
Okay.
The principal district of Persia,
yeah.
the nation was called Elamais in Greek, and that's the Elam of the Hebrews.
Mm-hmm.
Wherever we see Elam in prophecy, the Persians in history fulfilled that role.
Right. Now, weren't these Elamites, otherwise known as Persians, the whitest of the white? Weren't they known for that?
Well, yeah, the Greeks described them as being ivory white, and they were Semites.
Yeah, so apparently they didn't live far south enough to get tanned. Right.
They dwelt basically where Iran is today,
uh-huh.
Except that they were west of the Euphrates, right?
Right.
And Egypt.
Right. Yes. and then probably, I think, on either side up the...
I'm sorry, east of the Euphrates.
East, okay, right.
But they were beyond the Euphrates from Babylonia.
Okay, and I'm trying to think of that other sea, not the Black Sea. What's the other one just east of it on the other side of the Caucasus Mountains? I think they settled there. And,
the Caspian Sea?
The Caspian Sea, and up the east coast of that sea as well. Okay. All right, and then the Medes?
Well, the Medes are Gepesites. They're Madai, right?
Okay.
They dwelt in what we know today as northern Iraq,
mm-hmm.
and along the shores of the Caspian, between the Caspian and the Black Sea,
right.
In part what we know as Armenia today.
Yeah. They did these Medes also settle on the northern shores of the Caspian Sea, what today would be called?
Well, the Medes were forcibly transplanted by the Scythians. According to Diodorus Siculus, a lot of the Assyrians and a lot of the Medes were forcibly transplanted by the Scythians to the region of the Tanais River, where later we find people called the Sarmatians.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, but it's my personal belief that Sarmatians and Scythians are very often confused,
okay.
and that some of the not all of what we identify the Sarmatians generally as Slavs,
mm-hmm.
but I would say that there are probably some tribes of Scythians that were really Slavs and some tribes of Sarmatians that were really Germanic Israelites that
mm-hmm.
we would consider Scythians, right?
Yeah. Okay.
So, the lines weren't that clean cut.
Okay. Yeah, right, because since they're brothers anyway, Shemites versus Japhethites, they're the same race. Very closely related tribes. And,
and the Assyrians would also be Shemites.
Right, right. Okay, very good. Verse 26, and all the kings of the north, again, we're probably talking about all of these northern Mesopotamian Shemites, Japhethites, that's who we're talking about here, far and near one with another, and all the kingdoms of the world, which are upon the face of the earth.
That word for world... It is 776, and it is Eretz.
Right.
I'm looking for
land, and it's repeated. It's got to be the same word, face of the earth. Okay.
No, face of the earth is Adama.
That's Adama. Oh, okay.
Meaning the ground, basically.
Right, and Adama. I think you could say it's also an idiom for wherever the Adamites are.
Well, it's the Adamic mm-hmm. earth, right?
Right,
the Greeks. But yeah. But basically, this description is an Eastern description of the entire Mesopotamia and the Levant and the Near East and the Mediterranean world.
Right. Yeah, it can't be the rest of the
world. We would consider to be the oikoumene of the Greeks, right? The Adamic
right.
world.
Right. Yeah, because this expression, the face of the earth, and you probably noticed I put out an email newsletter this week about Noah's flood not being global, and a lot of people came back, well, it says the face of the earth, right? Well, the face of the earth is just a portion of it. It's not the whole earth.
Well, I don't see any Chinese people or Japanese people or
right.
South American Indians or short brown squat monsters mentioned here.
No.
Except a couple of Arabs and Ishmaelites.
Right, right. And King Sheshach.
Well, whether we like it or not, they are a part of the world, right?
Right.
I mean, the Ishmaelites and the Arabs, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, as for Sheshach, the king of Sheshach, that word only appears in scripture twice, right?
Okay.
It's Sheshach is mentioned again in Jeremiah 51:41, where it certainly appears to be a name given to Babylon, where it says, how is Sheshach taken,
uh-huh.
and how is the praise of the whole earth surprised? How is Babylon become an astonishment among the nations?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the word doesn't appear anywhere else but in those two passages. I don't know of it in any secular sources. I checked ancient Near Eastern texts and didn't see it, right?
Okay.
Yet in the both places in the Septuagint, the name is wanting in these verses.
Oh. Okay.
Okay. So now this may only indicate that the translators, when they made the Septuagint, didn't know how to handle the word and merely omitted it, seeing that since it was evident that Babylon was also referred to explicitly,
mm-hmm.
that it really wasn't necessary to repeat the word but because it's incomprehensible, yet they seem every other name to transliterate, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's it seems that they stayed faithful to that. So from the other side of the stick, it's odd that Sheshach is missing in the Septuagint.
Right. Okay. Interesting. Yeah, you think it could be a later addition by a scribe just to clarify?
Well, I don't know the name from the Greek history, so I don't know how it could be a clarification.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, you know, the name's an enigma to me, except that one commentary said that perhaps it's named after it's a name that's taken as a pejorative again about concerning Babylon, after some goddess named Shaq.
Okay.
But that was a commentary, I think, in Matthew Henry, and I've never heard of that goddess. So it beckons more investigation, but I don't know if it's worth investigating.
Right. He was a basketball player named Shaq, right?
Yeah, right.
Okay. Well, just out of curiosity, do you have an interlinear Septuagint with the Greek and the English, or are you just working off of a Greek?
Well, I can see the Greek and the English, yeah. When I check the Septuagint, I check the Greek.
Okay. So you can pretty much gauge the English to see if the translators are doing their job right.
Well, and I'm going to be honest, in the Septuagint, in Brenton's Septuagint, you have to check the Greek.
Uh-huh.
Because Brenton, I have hundreds of examples of passages where it marked off in my copy, where Brenton actually, in many cases, ignored the Greek and followed the King James.
Really?
I swear.
Really?
And it's sometimes, usually he's good, but I don't know if he got lazy at points, or if he just was sloppy, or if he just didn't want to follow the Greek.
Well, that's son of Zimri.
Many clear examples where Brenton ignored the Greek and applied a reading very much like we find in the King James, where the Greek says something different.
They're always tampering with our literature, aren't they? Amazing. Absolutely amazing. Okay. Well, yeah, because if the Masoretic has been universalized, Brenton must assume, well, why shouldn't the Septuagint be universalized, right?
Well, right, but a lot of times it's not even that. It's just silly stuff.
Right. Okay. All right, verse 27. Therefore you shall say to them, thus says Yahweh of hosts, the God of Israel, drink you and be drunken, and spew, that's vomit, and fall and rise no more because of the sword which I will send among you. Revelation 18:3. It shall be, if they refuse to take the cup at your hand to drink, then shall you say to them, thus says Yahweh of hosts, you shall certainly drink. What does that mean? You will be punished. You will have to drink your own poison. For lo, I begin to bring evil on the city, or that is punishment, which is called by my name, and should you be utterly unpunished? You shall not be unpunished, for I will call for a sword upon all the inhabitants of the earth. Again, not the whole earth, because we're only talking about Jerusalem and Judea, okay? As the Lord of hosts says. So you have to be careful that this expression, inhabitants of all the inhabitants of the earth, does not mean the whole planet here.
it means these nations that he's listed in the prior passage, which is basically what the Greeks would call the oikoumene, or that part of the world inhabited by the Adamic race.
Yeah.
Basically Yahweh's saying that, you know, if we read back through the prophets, we'll see that he scattered his people among these Mesopotamian nations as punishment, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, he told us at the end of Isaiah where his people were going to go, okay? And they basically all went west.
Mm-hmm.
If we read the last chapter of Isaiah, it tells us where these people of the Assyrian dispersion are going to go. They're going to go into Europe and be scattered from along all the Japhethite lands, which is basically exactly where the Cimmerians, the Goths, the Saxons, where they went, all the way as far as the lands of Tarshish. And Isaiah mentions Lud, and Lud is in Anatolia, but also the Etruscans are descended from the Lydians of Anatolia. That's in Italy. So we're going to find Yahweh's people in Anatolia and in Italy.
Right.
And Tarshish is mentioned, and several other Japhethite lands of Europe and Eurasia are mentioned, and that's where the Scythians went.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what. So
right.
They were to be distributed into all these lands as a punishment, as being put off in punishment. And now, if we see what we already saw in chapter 24, and we'll see it again in chapter 29, and we'll see it in Luke, where the enemies, the bad figs, are going to be scattered amongst all the nations, and as a punishment.
Right.
And what this passage here in this chapter is saying is that all of these other Adamic nations are going to be punished along with the children of Israel because the children of Israel are being punished.
Yeah, right. And are all violating the law, even though they have, you know, they haven't taken the oath that our ancestors did at Sinai in Leviticus 19:8, I believe it is. But nevertheless, you can't be doing evil. Yahweh will punish you for doing evil, whether you took that oath or not. Okay? It has no use for evildoers. Okay? So now, along these lines, it's obvious to me, and it's kind of an aside, but I think it's an important aside for the history of what's going on here. The descendants of Abraham and Keturah. Keturah was a Hamitic woman from Egypt, but she was definitely white. There's absolutely no doubt about that. Because
well, that's Hagar was from Egypt, right?
Oh, is he, and Keturah was a handmaid of Sarah, also, right?
The first time Keturah is mentioned, I'm in Josephus. Don't ask me
okay.
How I ended up. I got to get back to the King James.
Right? Okay.
I'm sorry. I just.
But as you're looking for that, the descendants of Abraham and Keturah were sent off east so that they would not interfere with Isaac's inheritance. Okay, those people, according to many British Israel scholars and others as well, became the Indo-Aryans. They moved east. Okay, but they didn't stay there forever. They had wars with the local people. They probably settled, I think maybe Kashmir was their favorite place to go. I think there were white people there already. So they settled in Kashmir, but along the Indus River. Those Indo-Aryans were actually descendants of Abraham and Keturah, but they wound up migrating along with the rest of our ancestors, whether they be Japhethites or Shemites, up into Europe. And so they moved north and west, just like the rest of our ancestors did. Okay.
There's no doubt that the Hebrews were dispersed across the Oikoumene at a very early time, and even Hebrews that weren't related to Abraham. It can be argued that the Pulaski of Greece were actually from the same line of Arphaxad.
Mm-hmm.
From Peleg, right?
Okay. Okay,
and that's they were originally called Pelagi. They weren't called Pulaski originally.
Okay,
and that's recorded by Strabo,
right?
And he imagined that they were called Pelagi after the storks, which is the name also very similar to the name, the Greek word for stork.
Uh huh.
But
okay.
But it might very well it's very plausible that explains the origin of some of the earliest Greeks, and the earliest Greeks also had that the earliest Greek myths also state that some of the earliest Greeks did come from the east.
Uh-huh.
And even that there's one Greek, I forget who it was, but in Hesiod's Theogony, a name Iapetus,
okay,
Iapetos. Appears as the ancestor of some of the Greeks.
Okay.
And Iapetus has to be Japheth.
Has to be, yeah.
There is no Greek
right. Etymology
for the word.
Right, right.
For the name, period.
Yeah.
There's no etymology in Greek for that name, Iapetus.
And probably one of the oldest Greek words, too.
Well, right. It certainly seems to. So there's a lot of things that can be tied in, but the textual evidence and the historical evidence is so scant that sometimes it's tenuous, right, to make the relationship.
Right.
And that's why very often
right.
I just don't.
Okay.
And or at least I don't record them. I can discuss them, but always with reservations, right?
Yeah.
I don't want to jump out there and insist something's true when I only have one reference, right?
Yeah.
Well, the Keturah is mentioned four times, in twice in Genesis 25 and twice in 1 Chronicles 1. And that's basically just a repeat of Genesis 25, but there's no indication of her genealogy.
Right.
But we just have to accept that if Abraham is going to make sure that Isaac gets a wife from among his kinsmen, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have to imagine that Abraham's not going to violate that
right.
rule of hell,
yeah.
right?
Exactly.
Otherwise, we're being
slanderous. He'd be a hypocrite.
Yeah.
Right.
He'd be a hypocrite or we would be slanderers.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So one quick question about linguistics here, because if it's the case that the original Greeks descended from Peleg and Japheth, wouldn't be Greek categorized as an Indo-Aryan language because they came from that neck of the woods?
Well, Greek is absolutely an Indo-Aryan language, just like Latin is and
mm-hmm.
Just like Hebrew is.
Okay.
And yes, I would insist that Hebrew is. There's a lot of Greek cognates in Hebrew.
Okay.
And the Greek word for market is agora. That's a Hebrew word meaning to gather.
Okay.
There's in my English is from Hebrew section. I haven't, I did that paper, English is from Hebrew. I did that list before I studied Greek.
Uh-huh.
If I could have the time to do that list again, I could probably add hundreds of words to it.
Right. Okay. So the Greek is definitely related to Hebrew and related to Indo-Aryan, but yet the scholars insist, at Jewish insistence, really, that Hebrew is a non-Indo-Aryan language. Of course, that's hogwash.
Well, right, but, Hebrew has many – it has all of the features – the constructions, some of them are different. Some of them are only different because of these kite bastards that claim to speak Hebrew today, right?
Right.
They've totally reinvented the language.
Mm-hmm.
When you take the original language, first you have the Phoenician alphabet.
Right.
Okay. And the Phoenicians supplied their alphabet and their language to a good portion of Greek, to a
uh-huh.
portion of Latin. And to almost all of the British, Irish, the Celtic,
yeah.
and the Saxon languages
yeah.
can be found to be derived from Hebrew,
yeah.
and Phoenician is basically Hebrew.
Right.
Oh, okay.
Exactly.
So Phoenician is Hebrew without the Masoretic crap.
Right.
It's basically, right, without the Masoretic additions.
Well, the reason I ask is because I got an email asking me about Phoenician and Hebrew, and he basically, coming from, how should I put this, the Judaized, secularized point of view, which tells us that Phoenician is older than Hebrew. And so he kept on insisting that Phoenician is older than Hebrew. And these scholars, they often admit that Hebrew and Phoenician are virtually identical, right?
Well, Phoenician doesn't exist in Phoenicia until the Israelites inhabit it.
Okay.
There's no Phoenician in Phoenicia until, first, it's a Greek word. It's only a Greek word.
Okay.
The word is not found in any other language. It's not an Assyrian word. It's not an Egyptian word. The Jews try to connect it to the idea of the Philistines and Palestine,
okay.
and that's just ridiculous
yeah.
because the Greek word phoinike
yeah.
is, by all rules of Greek grammar, comes from the Greek word phoinis, which
right.
means blood red.
Okay. So given
okay.
the fact that there's no Phoenicians ever in history and therefore couldn't have had their own language until around 1200 B.C., and that the Hebrew language existed, 2,000 years before then, right? What language were Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth speaking? They were speaking something like Hebrew.
Well, absolutely. And it's when we look at the archaeology of the Levant, we have cuneiform in the Hittite language and in several, even in
right.
some languages that we're not sure of, we have cuneiform inscriptions. When we look at Aramaean, we have cuneiform in the lands of Syria, inscriptions predating the Hebrew invasion of the Levant in the time of Joshua.
Right.
We have cuneiform inscriptions in Palestine.
Right.
We don't have Phoenician or Hebrew inscriptions until the 14th century B.C.
Okay. So it made a change from cuneiform to what we would call now Paleo-Hebrew.
Well, the Hebrew language came in, and the Phoenician script appeared when the Hebrews invaded the Levant and took it over.
Okay. So the Phoenicians are definitely Hebrews, and the language the Phoenicians spoke is Hebrew, and that's it. Everything else the scholars of the secular world and the Jews tell us is lies. That's basically all there is to it. The Phoenicians
now,
are Hebrews?
There are many features of the Hebrew language that are found in all the Indo-European languages. It's an inflected language, like all of the Indo-European languages. It has, and the Greek, early Greek had what's called a dual, which Hebrew has, okay? But the dual was dropped by Greek and by almost all the Indo-European languages, and I think maybe all of them, I might be safe to say that, I'm not sure, I don't know them all, right, have dropped the dual.
The dual is
singular and plural, right?
Right.
Where we have a singular form of the word and a plural form of the word. Hebrew also has a dual form of the word. And originally, Greek also had a dual form of the word.
Which means what?
Well, instead of the singular form or the plural form, you would have a third form that designated two of something.
Oh, okay. So it just means two.
Yes.
We just have one and many.
Of three numbers in noun, singular, plural, instead of two, singular and plural, we would have three forms, singular, dual, and plural.
Okay.
And Hebrew has that, and so did Greek, but the Greeks dropped it, and some Greek words retained it, which is how we know that they had it.
Oh, okay. Very good. Okay. All right. Well, let's continue here. Verse 30, we're in Jeremiah chapter 25. Therefore prophesy you against them all these words, and say to them, Yahweh shall roar from on high and utter his voice from his holy habitation. He shall mightily roar upon his habitation. He shall give a shout, as they that tread the grapes against all the inhabitants of the earth. Now, the grapes here is in italics, meaning it's been added.
Well, it's because of the verb there for tread, usually, grapes, the King James thought it would be safe to add the word.
Yeah. let's eliminate it and eliminate the comma and read it this way. As they that tread against all the inhabitants of the earth? Wouldn't that make sense?
Well, that would make more sense, yes.
Okay.
And we have in Revelation 14, we have the same same picture, right?
Yeah.
Of the harvest of the earth and the angels of God treading the grapes.
Right.
But,
right.
It's obvious there that he's speaking about people.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Right. And they just... they just fudged the issue by adding the word grapes. Yeah. Okay, verse 31. A noise shall come even to the ends of the earth, for Yahweh has controversy with the nations. He will plead with all flesh. He will give them that are wicked to the sword. Thus says Yahweh, behold, evil shall go forth from nation to nation, and a great whirlwind shall be raised up from the coasts of the earth, and the slain of Yahweh shall be at that day from one end of the earth even to the other end of the earth. They shall not be lamented, neither gathered nor buried, nor shall they shall be dung upon the ground. Now, this actually sounds like a vision of the end times as well as the judgment that's coming upon the city of Jerusalem. And, of course, we are Jerusalem prophetically. So whether it's intended as an end time prophecy or not, we need to take heed of what's being said here. Verse 34, howl, you shepherds, and cry, and wallow yourselves in the ashes, you principal of the flock, for the days of your slaughter and of your dispersion are accomplished, and you shall fall like a pleasant vessel. And the shepherds shall have no way to flee, nor the principal of the flock to escape. or the master or head of the flock. A voice of the cry of the shepherds and a howling of the principal of the flock shall be heard, for Yahweh has spoiled their pasture, and the peaceable habitations are cut down because of the fierce anger of Yahweh, and he has forsaken his covert hiding place as the lion, for their land is desolate because of the fierceness of the oppressor and because of his fierce anger. Okay, that's chapter 25. Any comments before I...
Let me say that, you know, we see this throughout the prophets. We saw it throughout Isaiah. We saw it throughout Ezekiel. And we imagine that it doesn't relate to us today, and it certainly does.
Mm-hmm.
But when we suffer calamity in our lives, we should know that it is for our chastisement.
Right.
And that is the will of God, and he is sovereign.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason for it. Paul tells us that if we go without chastisement, we are more likely to be bastards and not sons, because Yahweh chastises his children.
That's
right?
Right.
Therefore, when the day of our chastisement comes, we must remind ourselves of the trials of Job. And when we prevail in our faith, we also shall be rewarded as Job was rewarded.
Right.
But which is why Job is such a shining example, and why it's so important to us.
Yes, yes. And,
that book.
And the life of Joseph is actually a mini version of the story of Job, because, you know, when his brothers turned against him, he went through hell, for 15 years or more before he was finally rewarded with having to suffer through all that tribulation?
Well, right, in 15 years. Well, that's a long time to be punished. Well, not if we are on the scale of forever.
Right.
But
right.
This life means nothing to us when you think about forever. Now, the another example is Jonah. Yahweh wanted Jonah to go on a particular mission. Now, this all worked to Yahweh's advantage, right? Because I don't think the Assyrians would have believed Jonah unless he came out of a fish. And I talked about why the Assyrians believed Jonah a few months ago, and it's posted on Christigenia. But Jonah didn't want to go on this mission. He didn't want to just take the easy way and hop on a camel and go to Nineveh, right?
Yeah.
So he went in the opposite direction. So Yahweh sent a storm upon this ship, and it was going to destroy the whole ship.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And the sailors figured out it's this Jonah character,
right,
that's the reason, and they're about to throw him overboard. Jonah said, yeah, throw me overboard. It's me.
Right.
So the whole ship's going to be destroyed in chastisement of Jonah,
mm-hmm,
for not doing what he was supposed to do. When we are being urged to do something by our spirit, we should do it, or possibly the people around us should suffer.
Right, suffer because of our lack of action. Yeah.
Well, right. When we are sinning, I don't care if you're cheating on your wife or you're gambling away your pay on Saturday night or whatever. When we are sinning, those around us also suffer, and we're going to be chastised for our sin,
right,
and those around us are going to suffer even more.
Right.
And that's the story of that's an example. That's one example of that is, mm-hmm, in Jonah.
Yeah.
And Jonah ended up doing what Yahweh wanted him to do.
Yeah.
But he did it the hard way. He wouldn't,
yeah,
do it the easy way,
right,
and he did it. There's no doubt he did it the hard way.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, the hardest way possible. Yeah, and Jonah is a reluctant Messiah, right? I don't want to go preach to those people. I can't stand those people. Don't make me do it, God. Don't make me do it, Yahweh. All right, chapter 26, verse 1. In the beginning of the reign of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, came this word of Yahweh saying. Now it says in the beginning of the reign. It wasn't the previous chapter.
Well, right. And we'll see the same language start chapter 27. And we see that this is in chapter 25, right? We see that it's about 605 or 604 B.C. It's It's the fourth year of Jehoiakim, right? It's
right.
The fourth year of this king, right?
Uh-huh.
And here it says in the beginning, but there's no question on the order of the manuscripts through 25:13. That there's no doubt that the Septuagint and the Masoretic text had the same order of the manuscripts, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we have to assume that it's safe to say that this 26:1 follows 25:1 in the manuscripts. Now Jehoiakim only reigned like 11 years,
mm-hmm.
11 or 12 years. It was from like 609 to 598, I think. Well, so we see that it's possible that his first 4 years, this vision came right after that one in 25. So the first 4 years is still considered the beginning of his reign, if we see that Jeremiah is actually recording this later on,
mm-hmm.
right, and yeah. not as it happens, that then this might he might have, in hindsight, called this the beginning of his reign.
Mm-hmm.
Now, otherwise, if he's writing it as it happens, he's a prophet, right? He should know how long Jehoiakim's going to reign, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So verse 2. Thus says Yahweh, stand in the court of Yahweh's house and speak to all the cities of Judah, which come to worship in Yahweh's house, all the words that I command you to speak to them, diminish not a word. If so be, they will hearken and turn every man from his evil way, that I may repent me of the evil which I purpose to do them because of the evil of their doing. So Yahweh is always ready to forgive us if we repent. Verse 4. And you shall say to them, thus says Yahweh, if you will not hearken to me to walk in my law, which I have set before you, to hearken to the words of my servants, the prophets whom I sent to you, both rising up early and sending them, but you have not hearkened, then will I make this house like Shiloh and will make this city a curse to all the nations of the earth. Any historical info on Shiloh?
Well, the word means peace, right?
Yeah.
But the city, Shiloh was the city of Ephraim. It's the city where the tabernacle and the ark were kept up until the time that David took Jerusalem, right?
Okay.
And Shiloh was this passage is clarified by Jeremiah 7:12, which I'll read here. But now go ye unto my place, which was in Shiloh, where I set my name at first. That's because the ark and the tabernacle in the wilderness were stationed at Shiloh for quite some time, for the whole period of the judges, right? For over 400 years until David took the Jerusalem from the Jebusites and moved the ark and the tabernacle to Jerusalem, right? And go now to my place which was in Shiloh, where I set my name at first, and see what I did to it for the wickedness of my people Israel. Shiloh was totally destroyed by the Assyrians, and he's saying that he's going to make Jerusalem like Shiloh.
Right. Okay.
And to see that, indeed, Jerusalem was made a desolation just as Shiloh was,
uh-huh.
and it has been a desolation ever since, right? And,
yeah.
And that also, aside from Jeremiah chapter 19, which says that Jerusalem will be broken like a bottle that Jeremiah broke, and it'll never be whole again. Well, Shiloh is a curse to us right to this day. It's still a curse to us,
mm-hmm.
and a desolate. It says it. I'll make it like a curse to all the nations of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And I will make this city like a curse to all the nations of the earth. And it still is today. How could Christians be blessing something that Yahweh has cursed?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's silly and it's ignorant that the Judeo-Christians are doing all this. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, verse 3. Verse 7. So the priests and the prophets and all the people heard Jeremiah speaking these words in the house of Yahweh. And, of course, they hear the prophets. They hear the prophets criticizing them, but it just goes in one ear out the other. Verse 8, now it came to pass when Jeremiah had made an end of speaking all that Yahweh had commanded him to speak to all the people, that the priests and the prophets and all the people took him, saying, you shall surely die.
Well, right, and this is so hypocritical of these people, because we see that you know, they had punished Jeremiah, I think it was in chapter 20, they put him in stocks, right?
Right.
But for a time, and then he was released. And then we saw in chapter 21, when the people recognized that they were in trouble, they came to call on Jeremiah and ask him what was going on. They wanted understanding from Jeremiah.
Yeah, right.
So when things are going their way, they want to kill the prophets. And when things aren't going their way, that they beg the prophets to help them.
That's right. That's right.
And that's the thing, you know, people, even people today, they don't think about God until they suffer calamity.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Boy, and calamity's coming, isn't it? All right, verse 10. When the princes of Judah heard these things, when they came up from the king's house to the house of Yahweh and sat down in the entry of the new gate of Yahweh's house.
I think you skipped verse 9.
I did? Okay. Why have you prophesied in the name of Yahweh, saying, this house shall be like Shiloh? Okay, they're asking him, right. They're saying, this shall be like Shiloh, and this city shall be desolate without an inhabitant. And all the people were gathered against Jeremiah in the house of Yahweh. And, of course, we're getting the same treatment here in Identity from the Judeo-Christians, who are always accusing us. You know, well, why are you criticizing us, right? We're criticizing them, right? And then all they can do is call us names, right? Verse 11, then spoke the priests and the prophets to the princes and to all the people, saying, this man is worthy to die, for he has prophesied against this city, as you have heard with your ears. We're prophesying against the Judeo-Christians. Verse 12, then spoke Jeremiah to all the princes and to all the people, saying, Yahweh sent me to prophesy against this house and against this city all the words that you have heard. Therefore,
what's going on here is a trial, right?
Yeah.
It's not really explicit, but this is a trial. This is an ancient trial. The city elders would sit in a gate, and your accusers would bring you to the elders before the gate. And that's exactly what's going on here. The priests brought Jeremiah to the princes of the city who sat in the city gate. And that they're putting him on trial for a capital offense is exactly what's happening here.
Verse 13, therefore now amend your ways and your doings and obey the voice of Yahweh your Elohim, and Yahweh will repent him of the evil that he has pronounced against you. But apparently they didn't understand what they were doing wrong. And, of course, they were denying that they were doing anything wrong.
All right. Now, and let me say that this is one of the charges that the Pharisees brought against Christ.
Yeah.
He spoke against the temple that he would destroy it and raise it in 3 days, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's it's a very similar charge to that charge that the Pharisees had against Christ.
Right. Okay. Verse 15, verse 14, as for me, behold, I am in your hand. Do with me as seems good and meet to you. So Jeremiah is saying, okay, well, you've got me.
well, right, but he's also challenging them
right. To
be righteous by treating him justly also. In other words, he's saying, don't shoot the messenger, because Jeremiah is claiming to be sent from Yahweh. So that means that he's an ambassador. And in the ancient world, ambassadors were considered sacred. And to that notion, Jeremiah is making his appeal.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying, hey, I was sent. Don't shoot the messenger. That's what he's saying.
Right, right. Okay. And then said, okay, right. But if you know for certain that if you put me to death, you shall surely bring innocent blood upon yourselves, and upon this city, and upon the inhabitants thereof, for of a truth, Yahweh has sent me to you to speak all these words in your ears.
And let me say that the Greeks and Romans,
mm-hmm.
they had the same exact custom.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Very good. Then said the priests and all the people to the priests and the prophets, this man is not worthy to die, for he has spoken to us in the name of Yahweh our God. Then rose up certain of the elders of the land and spoke to all the assembly of the people, saying, Micah the Morassite prophesied in the days of Hezekiah, king of Judah, and spoke to all the people of Judah, saying, thus says Yahweh of hosts, Zion shall be plowed like a field, and Jerusalem shall become heaps, and the mountain of the house and the high places of the forest. So he's defending.
Well, right. It seems here that the people, the common people, understood Jeremiah.
Right.
Okay? But the appointed priesthood despised him because he threatened their perceived authority and legitimacy.
Right.
It's the priests that dragged Jeremiah to this trial.
Right, yeah. And as we find in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, it's always the leaders of the people that begin the corruption process, right?
Well, right. And here the priests are showing themselves to be corrupt, and the people are showing themselves to still be more noble.
Right. Very good.
Because they're saying, well, Micah said that Jerusalem was going to be destroyed, and not even Hezekiah would put him to death.
Right, right. Okay, verse 19. Did Hezekiah, king of Judah, and all of Judah put him at all to death? Did he not fear Yahweh and besought Yahweh, and Yahweh repented him of the evil which he had pronounced against them? Thus might we procure great evil against our souls. And there was also a man that prophesied in the name of Yahweh, Uriah, the son of Shemaiah of Kirjath-Jearim, who prophesied against the city and against this land according to all the words of Jeremiah. And when Jehoiakim the king with all his mighty men and all the princes heard his words, the king sought to put him to death. But when Uriah heard it, he was afraid and fled and went to Egypt. And Jehoiakim the king sent men into Egypt, namely Elnathan, the son of Achbor, and certain men with him into Egypt. And they brought forth Uriah out of Egypt and brought him to Jehoiakim the king, who slew him with the sword and cast his dead body into the graves of the common people. Nevertheless, the hand of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, was with Jeremiah that they should not give him into the hand of the people to put him to death. Okay.
Now Uriah is only mentioned in a few places. This particular Uriah.
Mm-hmm.
But this Uriah must have gotten afraid, right? First, Ahikam is an elder of the people who defended Jeremiah.
Mm-hmm.
And this prophet Uriah should also be an example to us of what happens of those who claim to serve Yahweh, which he evidently from this did, yet who in a time of trouble shrank from his duties and fled for safety,
yeah,
rather than putting his faith in his God. After he fled, he was slain,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Where he may have been defended like Jeremiah if he stood up for the truth and
right,
did not flee, as Jeremiah certainly did.
Yeah.
We see a lot later in Jeremiah that the son of Ahikam, who comes to his aid here, Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, the son of this Ahikam becomes Jeremiah's guard later on and accompanies Jeremiah to Egypt.
Oh, okay.
in chapters 39 through 43, and specifically see 43:6. This Ahikam, who defended Jeremiah here, that the hand of Ahikam was with Jeremiah, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure he was moved by Yahweh to protect Jeremiah.
Sure.
And he was an influential man in the city. He was a captain of the guard. And Ahikam was made governor of Judah by Nebuchadnezzar later on, for which see chapter 40, verse 5.
Okay. All right. Very good. Very good. Okay. Well, that takes us to the end of Jeremiah chapter 26. And we'll save Jeremiah chapter 27 for 2 weeks from tonight because I won't be here next weekend. And so I know you and Clifton have...
On Friday I'm going to have a discussion about Clifton. Well,
okay.
With Clifton about Jeremiah, yes. Well,
oh, okay.
Clifton has written an awful lot on the good and the bad figs and on the broken bottle.
Okay.
Nation of Jeremiah 19, and I think that he could probably add a lot to our conversation.
Very good. And then, so next Saturday, you're going to be doing then part 3 of your, what was it, the title of that?
Errors Inspired by Who, yes.
Okay, so you get
my
part
series,
3.
Ongoing series pointing out, it's probably the last part of the series.
Okay.
Pointing out the simple translation errors in the King James Version of the Bible, the plain errors in translation, which have a great impact on our understanding of it.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And then I think you and Greg will start the Testament of Joseph, because that's a really long testament.
So you and Greg can start it, and then I'll pick up on it the following Sunday with Greg. Okay, so we'll have that scheduled for next week. And now tomorrow we'll be continuing our series on the Book of Revelation, and then Sunday my guest will be Mike Hallamore of Kingdom Identity Ministries, and he is the guy who put together the it's a whole identity theological course. I forget what they call it now.
Right, it just needs a few corrections.
Yeah, a few corrections, but it's basically two seed line, you know, which is
it's, for the most part, it's a good course.
Yeah, and so we'll be talking about that, and he, I think he knew Swift and Comparay, so we'll get a little bit of background, you know, how he got into Christian identity. So that should be a really good show. Looking forward to that. Okay.
Well, you know, I was a correspondent of Lorraine Swift's for many years.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And she mentioned to me several times that Mike Hallamore was basically the inheritor of the Swift ministry. A lot of people want to attribute that to Butler. Butler claimed it, but he didn't have it. Not according to Lorraine Swift.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, you know, she didn't have much care for Richard Butler at all, from what I understand.
Uh-huh. Yeah, she didn't like him. Yeah. But, I guess whenever somebody dies, in fact, when Butler died, 5,000 or 6,000 guys claimed to be his successor, right?
Well right. And according to Lorraine, it was Mike Hallamore that you know, was the official inheritor of Wesley Swift's ministry.
Very good, very good. All right. Okay. So thanks, Bill, for helping me do this study in Jeremiah. We still got a lot of chapters left in Jeremiah, but we're getting into some of the really good stuff, end time prophecies here coming up. And so we'll pick that up 2 weeks from tonight, and then you and Clifton next Friday night. And then if I have a chance, I'm going to be probably in Texas. I'll see if I have a chance to listen in. You know, that would be fun. Okay. All right. So thank you all for listening tonight, and we'll see you all tomorrow night. Yahweh bless everybody.
Praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh.